Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
You're listening to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and I have to admit, I'm so glad that the microphones in Studio 2 are directional because you can't pick up the growling in my stomach. I'm really hungry today, and that's perfect because celebrity chef Tiffany Faison is back with us. Tiffany, how are you?
Hi, I'm good, Tiziana. How are you?
I'm good, thanks. Are you hungry?
I'm always hungry.
Good.
I live in general starvation, and that's metaphorical and literal.
So we have so much I want to talk to in our monthly check-in today, and I'm going to start with a little funny anecdote you wouldn't know. So here in Studio 2, you're on the line today, but usually you're here. You know we've got these two TV screens up here, right?
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
In the 10 o'clock hour, I'm in the studio much of the time, and CNN is on, and they often run an ad for Chopped, which means most days of the week, I see you up on the screen before the show. I wave at you, like, hi, Tiffany, even though you don't see me. And it got me to thinking, are you still having a lot of fun on food television?
Oh, the most fun. It's interesting. I think, you know, it's been a journey. I started with Chopped, my goodness, in 2017 as a guest judge and became a full-time judge. January of 2020, and it's just like anything. I think, you know, it took a while for me to find a level of comfort in it, and once I was able to do that, you know, the relationship has deepened both with, you know, my judges and chefs that come on and compete, and producers and people that you form relationships with this in, and it becomes that much more fun, and it becomes that much more rich, frankly. So, yeah, of course, I more than ever.
So it's really so popular still, food television is. And I wonder, what is it, I'm saying it like it's some big monolith, right? But what is food television and competitive food television really getting right now, Tiffany?
It's so interesting because I do think that there's an evolution that's happening in it. You know, there's on the back end of it, we're having a lot of conversation about what we want to do and what we think viewers want to see and where we want to push it. And that's not like me leading the conversation. That's different. That's the network and different production companies. And so there's always, you know, a want to continue to evolve it. But at the core, I think the things that it gets right, different shows in different forms of shows do different things. I think, you know, shows that are like the shows that are Ina Garten and Ree Drummond and people that are showing you how to cook things, I think there's an educational aspect to it, obviously, and that goes back to, you know, the early days of Julia and Jacques. And there's a breakdown of showing you how we do, showing, you know, the viewer and the home cook how we do things that feels very accessible, like breaking things down and showing you step by step how things can really be done. And maybe you can't make the whole coq au vin, but you understand now what wine does when it's added to a dish and what, you know, browning something adds to a dish. And so the culmination of things, I think matters for the home cook. And then I think there's an element of food competition that allows the viewer to put themselves in both the seat of the judge and the competitor. And there's a sense of, you know, oh, I could do this better. And even when chefs watch, you know, it's kind of...
No, like I just want you to know, I never say that ever. Oh, I could do that better.
It's wild to me because when other chefs are, you know, people that cook professionally watch either Top Chef or Chopped or whatever it is, there is that sense of like, oh, I would do this. It's very Monday morning quarterback. And then you see them come into the arena and it becomes one of the harder things they've ever done. And a lot of that, like, oh, this is what I would do, bravado goes right out the window. So I think for people, it allows them to kind of take on the role of the judge and also the competitor, which is really compelling. And then you see something be created from literally nothing on a cutting board to the finished product. And you get to see the creative process, which I think, whether it's food or whether it's, you know, different forms of art or film, I think that's so compelling.
So I want to stay in the competition space. I'm going to take a hard left, though, and it makes me realize that all the things I want to talk to you about today, we're going to kind of go, we're high, we're low, we're high, we're low. It's just kind of...
So it's life, right?
Yeah, exactly, exactly. So tomorrow we are going to do a whole show that is marking 10 years since the Boston Marathon bombings. And we're going to stay focused on service and hope. But we got to thinking about the fact that Sweet Cheeks, of course, on Boylston Street. I actually don't know if you were open that day, but I wanted to ask you, memories of that time and being a restaurateur in that area, just your thoughts.
It was 2013. We opened in 11. So, being an owner and having that level of responsibility was still fairly new to me. I was there. We open early every year in Sweet Cheeks. This year is no different. We open at 9:30. We do breakfast. The game starts at 11, and then we go all the way through Tenderoni's. We open at 1 this year. I'm going to plug us. We were so much that we didn't know when it happened. And I don't know if you remember this, but right around that time, earlier in the year, or maybe the summer before, there was a generator that blew on Boylston Street. It was a really loud event. And so that was the thought really early on, that maybe it was this generator that had gone again. We learned, it wasn't quick. Like I don't think we knew that it was a bomb that there were bombs for a couple hours. And I had a lot of, I have a lot of college kids that work for me. So it was, once we knew what had happened, I essentially was, trying to keep my team calm. There were guests in the restaurant, and it's the most celebratory day in Boston, as you know. We all love Patriots Day. We love Marathon Monday. It's so unique to us. And so we ended up deciding to turn the televisions to the local news to see what was happening, because everyone that was in the restaurant really wanted to know what was going on. I was in the office answering the phone because I had, at the time we had a no cell phones policy on the floor, and I had a lot of college kids that were there and their parents were calling, trying to just make sure that they were okay. So I was answering the phone a bunch. And then as the afternoon wore on and we had more information, the restaurant cleared out. I remember talking to Ross and, David Tasteburger, and we were literally standing on Boylston Street trying to figure out what we do. Do we close? Do we stay open? What do we do? I think we stayed open and maybe closed a little bit early. And then the next day we started taking food down to that area and just feeding whoever we could, because there were so many people that were stuck in Boston and didn't have a place to go and didn't, were staying with, I don't know if you remember at this point, there were like listservs where you could have people come stay in your home. And so there's just so much uncertainty and fear. And so that week it was so unreal. We stayed open the rest of the week. And I remember Friday morning, we had our AM sous chef that was in the restaurant, and there was some, the city went on lockdown.
Yeah.
And we had heard that there were maybe some sightings in Kenmore Square. And so I'm on the phone with my AM sous, and she was in the office, and they said, just keep the door locked. And she was terrified. And I was thinking about trying to get to her. We finally got her home, and watching that unfold on Friday. I mean, I don't speak for just us. I speak for the entire city. I know when it was that week was just surreal. Thanks to the incredible work of, the governor at the time and the head of police and the FBI and everyone, it was able to be resolved that Friday night and be wrapped up and have us all feeling like we were safe and on our way back to a new normal for sure.
Yep.
It was, I 10 years later, I still don't have words for it, but watching the resiliency of the city and everyone really come together to get each other through was something that is so uniquely Boston, and something that I I, with everyone else in the city, remain really proud of, and know that in another city, it may not have resolved itself in the way that it did as quickly and as heroically as it did here.
And that's the hope piece, isn't it?
It is. Sorry, I have a brand new puppy who knows no bounds right now.
That's okay. I don't want any bounds with the new puppy.
That's the hope piece. And I think, you know, one of the things that we do talk about that I think maybe always deserves a little bit more of a light shone on it is, you know, we obviously, the amount of injuries that happened were horrific, but the amount of casualties were minimal. And that is unique to us because of the amount of level one trauma hospitals we have in the city.
All right, so I'm going to stay in the tough space a minute longer. We're going to shine light on another question, and then we're going to move back into a more joyful space. I'm going to stick with the restaurant industry here. Early in February, Ming Tsai made a comment or a joke about roofying Irene Lee at a curated cuisine event at WBUR City Space. He also arguably dismissed a question that she asked him about a comment that you'd actually made to me at an earlier City Space event about a need for more of a reckoning in the Boston restaurant industry. Now, Lee then made public comments after Ming Tsai issued a partial apology. There's more coverage about all of that on WBUR's The Common. You and I have talked a lot about your push for fairness, for equity, for workers in the industry. What is something that men and women in leadership in the Boston restaurant industry need to do now in this movement, in this moment, to move the industry forward?
I think first and foremost, the recognition that we have not had enough conversation about this. I think it was all the, you know, it was really hard to watch, obviously. It was hard to watch something like that be said to any woman. More specifically, Irene, who's been a leader in our industry. You know, I sometimes wonder, I think that the nature of it being sort of cavalier and a bit of a joke does really just bring to light and calls more attention to the fact that we have not had enough conversation. And the questioning of, haven't we talked about this enough? You know, I feel a little, I still don't know entirely how to process that. I think when you're a person that has lived in a space where, you know, being a woman or a minority or a person of color or someone who's queer or, you know, check all the boxes, to have the, it's so hard to put words to this, when, you know, it's happened in this very public way with someone that, you know, our city and frankly I have loved and respected for a long time. The nature of the cavalierness of saying haven't we talked about it enough, and being able to make a joke like that really, I think, just calls to light the fact that we have not talked about it enough. And frankly, the conversation that we have had has not had any depth or meat to it, frankly, or else I don't think the jokes would have been made.
So the answer is it's time to have some more conversation.
And in-depth conversation, right? Like really let's excavate this issue and you know, it's interesting in all of the conversations, not all of them, but a lot of them that I've had, I can probably speak for a lot of women and people of color, have not had anyone reach out and say, really, besides media, frankly, haven't had a cis white male or cis male in this space who's enjoyed incredible deals and the adoration of our, and deservingly so in so many ways, of our communities. I've never had one of them sit down and say, like, tell me what your experience really has been like. I've had people say, you know, I know it's been hard for women in this space, and I can't imagine what it's been like for you. And it's always like a little bit of, like a slow pitch softball, and then they hit it themselves, right? Like, it's never like, hey, how's it been for you? Like, I really want to know what this experience has been like for you. We're having this conversation, and I think I know, or I think I might have some understanding of it, but can you tell me what it's really been like for you, and how do you think it's impacted your career? I think unfortunately, of the conversation that's been had, or the want to remedy or make the situation better in a lot of male-driven kitchens has been out of fear for, lack of a better term, being busted or being seen in like a crappy light. It's not particularly altruistic or has a lot of it doesn't have the depth of wanting to understand the experience of the person on the other end of it.
Tiffany, I appreciate you taking the time to give such a thoughtful answer. It's a lot, and you really thought about it, and I thank you. Yeah, it is. Thank you for engaging, as you always do when you join us. Chef Tiffany Faison, thanks for being with us today. Happy spring.
Thank you. Happy spring, and happy Marathon Monday. Have a great one.